This is the Mantor Shift Podcast, coming out every second Thursday with Mickey Fahair.
Hey man, welcome to Mantor Shift. If you're here, you're probably like me. Sometimes you feel like you carry the entire world on your shoulders and it's heavy, and you want to get together with some fellow men and listen to their inspirational stories and be inspired and inspire others. So welcome, you've come to the right place. I want to start by asking you two things. If you like what we do, first of all, please subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast platform. All you have to do is one click and you will get all of our episodes as they come out. Secondly, give us a rating. Ratings are hugely important for us. They get us more listeners. Please give us 2 minutes, 1 minute, and just give us a good rating. And thirdly, if you want to give us your appreciation, you could go to our sponsor's website. Our sponsor is mindsetmaps.com, so www.mindsetmaps.com, and do your mindset map inventory. It's a free tool and it's going to give you an idea of whether your mindset is actually supportive and aligned regarding important life and business goals that you have set out for yourself. Perhaps you assume that that's always like that, but I'm telling you it's not. If you haven't done it, try it. Get out of your autopilot and take charge of your mindset. Thanks for being here. And now, let's get to the episode. All right, so welcome, a warm welcome to Julius Strauss. And, you know, this is kind of a reunion, and we were trying to guess, you know, how many years. But I know you as a journalist, as a war correspondent, and then, you know, I read about your adventures in Canada as a wilderness guide. And then I read an article in The Guardian about, you know, doing some project with veterans, and all of this is, you know, really interesting. And this is a podcast, you know, for men and not just for men, and, you know, for us to kind of share life stories, inspiration, you know, what creates meaning in life. So, you know, first of all, thank you very much for being here. It's an honor. Good to have you.
My pleasure.
And you know, where do we start? Maybe kind of let's start in terms of your career. So we go back, I don't know, 20 years, and you're a journalist. And I remember that, you know, what was also intriguing is not just the fact that you were a journalist, but you were a war correspondent, which is a very special type of journalism. So maybe if you can share a little bit, you know, what brought you into that profession.
Yeah, good question. I mean, I think ultimately it was curiosity in the very beginning. I mean, I grew up at a time when World War II wasn't that long behind. I mean, it was several decades, but it was very much part of my identity. My father's Hungarian, my mother's Welsh, and both my grandfathers had fought in the war. But I always thought of war as being part of history, something that old people talked about. And and then I was in Hungary right when at the time communism fell, and that was my first little taste of violence, if you like. I was in Romania during the revolution in 1989 in December, then again the following year. And so the first time I saw, you know, any form of shooting, first time I saw people beaten up in a mob situation, and it terrified me, it scared me, but I also found it extremely intriguing. So I guess that was a little kind of teaser, taster, and I didn't probably think about it very much at the time, but when the Yugoslav war started in 1991 and in the Serbo-Croat war in 1992 in Bosnia, I was, you know, it was only a few hours drive away from where I was in Budapest. And so I was intrigued by it. And eventually I couldn't resist my curiosity. So I drove down to see what it felt like and what it looked like and what it smelled like and what it, yeah, the whole experience. And I think from then on in, I was hooked. It's a complicated form of, I don't want to use the word addiction. It's not an addiction, but it's a complicated compulsion. It's not as simple as being, people have said to me, oh, you're an adrenaline junkie. It's not that simple. It's more complicated than that. But you find some kind of meaning, some kind of something fairly extreme, I suppose, in war. And that kept me involved in wars for most of the next 15 years.
It's really interesting because, I completely get the idea of, well, it's really interesting and it's really intriguing. But yet, most of the people, they try to run away or, avoid it at all costs. So it's an actually kind of extraordinary reaction and an interesting reaction that, instead of wanting to, I experienced it. It was really scary. Never want it again. You kind of go, well, maybe I should try more of that. So I don't want to kind of put you on a spot, but I'm really intrigued myself. Like, what was it that it was giving you in terms of, so you said something like meaning, for example, what was the meaning or what was it that you were?
Yeah. I mean, you have that double reaction, and especially at the beginning, you're absolutely correct. I ran away as many times as I stayed where I was, and something would happen and I'd run away and then I'd feel bad and go back again. But in terms of what keeps you there, it changes. In the beginning, there is a lot of novelty and there's a lot of excitement. And it's something we don't talk about very much in our society. It's a little bit taboo to talk about, what a thrill it is to be a soldier in Afghanistan at the age of 19, or what a thrill it is to go to Iraq and be part of a extremely kind of poignant, it's more than poignant, a sort of life and death situations. Right. And yes, it's scary, and yes, you can get trauma from it and all those things, but it's also just very, very exciting. And so as a young man, to go to these places and experience that, the excitement, the pure thrill was a motivating factor at the beginning. But with time, things change. And after a while, you can't just be a voyeur. You can't just be there for the fun of it. You can't be there, not do anything. That seems terribly kind of self-centered and selfish, I suppose, but more than selfish, it just seems you can't justify it. So if you stay, and I think for me, war probably came before journalism. Journalism didn't come before war. Then you've got to find a reason to stay. And as time goes on, I think the thrill seeking kind of transforms or metamorphosizes into something that's probably closer to justice seeking. You feel that you want to expose what's going on. It feels unfair. It feels that it challenges your worldview. You don't want to, you don't want to accept it. So you've got to tell the world about it. And that's a phase as well. And eventually you progress into different phases. It becomes more complicated.
Mm, very interesting. And by the way, was that a man's environment? So you kind of mentioned, being a young man and being thrilled and, the pure adventure and the thrill of it. Was it more men that you found, sort of in these situations along with you who were also kind of attracted to it? Or not really?
No, I mean, well, in terms of fighting, yes, definitely. It was mostly men. You came across the occasional woman fighting, but it was unusual. But in terms of journalism, no. I mean, even back then, and this is going back 30 years now, there were a good number of women correspondents and women war correspondents. And now there are a lot more than there were back then. So, no, I wouldn't say that side of things was a man's environment, although the military obviously is quite a masculine kind of hard thing. And it was very sort of egalitarian in a sense. I mean, we certainly didn't differentiate amongst each other. It wasn't, if you were a woman, you didn't take less risks or you weren't expected to have it any easier than if you're a man. In fact, some of the women I worked alongside with were remarkable correspondents. One or two of them became quite famous. At least one of them was killed. They were absolutely dedicated and every bit as hard as the men, I think. Yeah.
Sure. No, that's really interesting that, you know, I was kind of wondering whether there were more men war correspondents, and it's good to hear that even already then, you know, that there were quite a few women. So, you know, then this thing kind of ended at some point. So, you know, I'm thinking in terms of phases, and you described the first phase of sort of like the honeymoon and the thrill, and then the meaning seeking and the justice telling, and, you know, announcing it, you know, telling the world what's going on. And then it somehow ended in your case. So you left sort of that profession. And what brought about the end, you think?
Two things, probably. I mean, I covered a lot of wars. I covered the Serbo-Croat War very minimally, but I covered a little bit of the Bosnian War. I covered the Kosovo War. I covered the war in Sierra Leone. I covered the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Chechnya. So I'd done a lot of wars. And I don't even know how many revolutions and, you know, random kind of bits of trouble. And after a while, it does take a toll on you. It takes a toll on your head. And there's kind of an unfortunate thing here, which is that I think to be a really good journalist, you need to have empathy. You need to have empathy with the people you're talking to and the people you're surrounded by. Right. But that's also what makes you vulnerable. So that's also means you pay a higher price for what you're doing. And that's how it was with me. I mean, I think the first, probably what sowed the seeds of trouble for me in terms of mental trouble was in Kosovo, and then Sierra Leone was particularly bad. A friend of mine was killed, my brother was taken hostage. But I think for me, these things were cumulative. I don't think there was any one thing that that happened. But by about 2000, 2001, when I'd been doing it for about 5 years, I realized that I was having trouble. And back then, post-traumatic stress disorder wasn't quite as accepted as it is today. And it took me, I was in denial for a long time. I just said, no, I don't have that. I've got some problem with my, you know, some congenital problem or some problem with my balance or problem with my something physical. And it took me quite a long time to accept that I did have some form of PTSD. And eventually a French doctor helped me in Moscow, and I was living in Moscow. But even then I decided not to give it up. And then finally in 2004, in September, some terrorists led by a bunch of Chechens stormed a school in southern Russia at a place called Beslan. And I was there during the shootout. There were only a couple of us who got through the cordon, and 300 people were killed, 180 of them were children, 170 something were children. And I remember walking away from that school, having seen all these bodies, and not just the bodies isolated, but the context, the killing, the dying, and I remember thinking to myself, you know, you've been struggling with this thing now for 3 or 4 years, and everything you've done to try and overcome it, you've just blown it. You haven't blown it right this second, but you've blown it. I knew it. I just knew it instinctively. So that was one thing. And then the other thing, I just met Kristen. And I'd fallen in love, and I wanted to be with her. And I realized my job was very, very bad for a relationship. And so it was almost at that point like a choice. Do I do something else and give it a go with this woman in my life that I cared a lot about? Or do I continue doing what I was doing? And I made the choice to change.
To change, right. So by the way, I was curious, you said, you know, a French doctor helped you. Did you actually then go into some form of therapy or help for a longer period of time? No,
I've never done therapy. I mean, I'm not against it. And if it happened again today, I think I dealt with my PTSD in the end, but it took a long time. Therapy would have probably shortcut that. No, I just got antidepressants. It was that simple. And antidepressants are a recognized treatment for PTSD. And it's not just about the depression side. It has some other chemical effects on your brain. I didn't take them for very long, maybe a year, 6 months to a year, perhaps. Mm-hmm. And then I came off them. So no therapy.
Yeah, got it. No, I do want to ask you about, you know, like your own remedy, because it wasn't therapy, it was something else. I understand that the pills, you know, may have played a temporary role, but it probably was something else, as you said, you know, making a choice. But before we go there, I'm still very intrigued. So maybe just one last question about, you know, the war experiences and the terrorism. Maybe it's an experience of violence, right? Like, it's not just war, but terror. So what have you learned about war and violence in all those years? Is there, you know, maybe, you know, one or two things that you would want to share, that you've kind of an insight that you've learned?
Well, yeah, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, war is a very moral place. That doesn't mean that people are more moral than in normal life, but morality is a central part of what is going on, whether it's good or bad. And often it's bad, but it can also be good. And that's something we often don't think about associated with war. But that, Alan, that amount of pressure on a human being brings out the best and the worst of them. So that's something that always intrigued me. And it's something I still miss war to this day. And it's been a while now.
Moral, how do you experience that? Like, what? So maybe it's a little too abstract for someone who hasn't experienced it like you. So what do you mean it's a moral place?
It's a very moral environment. You have to make life or death decisions quite often, maybe not every day, but quite often. And you're often torn between doing what you should be doing and what the right thing is. Or you have to make, I mean, just to give you one example, I was in a Kosovo village one day and I was with some women and children. And I had the option of trying to get, there was a lot of shooting going on and the village was under fire. And I had the option of trying to take them out of the village in my car. The problem was, I was an accredited journalist, and if the Serbs had seen me, they could legitimately have taken away my accreditation, but many other people's accreditation too. They have simply said, these Western journalists are not being journalists. They're doing other stuff that they shouldn't be. So that you're pitting a professional obligation there against a personal obligation or a moral obligation. And these things come up fairly often. And yeah, in an extreme war situation, they come up a lot. And things, you know, some of the things like, I don't know, bravery, generosity, forgiveness, things that we don't really get tested on in our everyday lives, although we do at some point, I guess, but not usually. They're just much more frequent in war. And the last thing I wanted to say is that, and this is, you know, for me, because the next stage of my life was about wilderness, and particularly today, what I really value about both war and wilderness is that they're real. And in a world where there's so much fakery, there's so much is about public profile, so much is about curating our images, so much is about something that is removed from reality, I find being in war, being in the wilderness, I find it a very grounding experience, even if it's not always a positive experience. And you know, I thought about this a lot recently, and I think what I need in my life is that, you know, going out partying and hanging out with friends and having a great time and all that stuff is good, but it's sugar. And sometimes you need a bit of salt in your life to balance that out. Mm. And for me, tracking a bear in Canada or going to Chechnya or whatever it is, that was the kind of salt that I needed. And I still need it to this day.
No, I totally get it. Yeah, thanks for sharing this. And so kind of now going back to this idea of, okay, so you realize that, you know, it's been happening for you for a couple of years. It's getting to you. It's not good. It's not good for the relationship. You got to make a choice. So you made the choice of leaving that job. And so did you guys already know what you're going to do, or you just started, you know, let's wander around Canada and see what happens?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, sort of. There was an interim step, but I decided to leave the newspaper I was working for and the paper I'd worked for 15 years. And I decided to stop being a war correspondent. So I called up the Canadian paper, the major Canadian paper, which is called the Globe and Mail. And I just said, hey, have you got a job? Mm-hmm. And they were a bit surprised. And they said, well, we've got this job in the middle of some farming community writing about, I don't know, farms and stuff. And the north and whatever. And so I said, all right, I'll take it. So I took that job, and that got us to Canada. And then even before the job started, we just randomly went on a long drive across Western Canada, and we came across this this place, this ranch, I guess you would call it, in the middle of nowhere, off the power grid, miles and miles from anywhere. And it was for sale. And I was there with Kristen, and we just fell in love with this place and decided that's what we wanted to do. But there was no plan. There was no money behind it. I mean, it was a disaster. Logistically, financially, it was a disaster.
Right.
Yeah. There you go.
It often is, right? Yeah. And then, you know, how did this idea come about? You know, it's going to be a bear lodge. It's going to have to do something with grizzlies. Like,
It came about a bit later. So we moved in there. Well, first of all, we had a hell of a drama getting the place because we didn't have enough money. So we put down all the money we had and promised to make the balance payment within 6 months. And we didn't have any way of doing that. So it was all a bit sketchy, but it did work out in the end. And then we moved in and we realized, well, this is great, but how do we pay the mortgage? How do we buy groceries? So the first year we just tried different things. I bought a whole bunch of quad bikes, which I didn't even know how to drive myself. I crashed one of them. We had two other accidents. It was a kind of comedy of errors. And we just lost money hand over fist. And at the end of that year, I sat down with Chris and I said, look, this isn't working clearly. If money was not an object, because we've been trying to think of ways to make a living. I said, look, if money was not an object, if we weren't interested in money, what would you want to do here? And we talked about it. We talked it back and forth a bit. And we came up with this idea of the bears, because we'd seen the bears and they were intriguing. And we thought, well, if they're intriguing for us, maybe they're intriguing for other sort of middle-class Westerners as well. And so that's how the bear idea came about. But it took several years to get it to a point where it was working. And luckily I got a job teaching at the University of Alaska for two semesters, which kept us going financially for those first couple of years.
Right. Okay. And so then, you know, you keep going, you're teaching, and it's slowly picking up. So what sort of guests were coming to the Bear Lodge? Like what sort of people did it attract?
It was a mix. I mean, it's a slightly niche thing in that there are quite a lot of places now in British Columbia where you can go and see bears, but most of the time you stand on a platform, you're above the bears are down there, and there's some kind of artificial place to attract the bears. Maybe there's some fish or something. What we do is totally different. We walk around grizzly bears in very small groups with highly trained guides. We don't carry weapons. So it's a more niche offering. So people who want something that is more real and closer to nature, but that comes with a certain amount of unpredictability in terms of how many bears you're going to see and that sort of thing, then it works really well.
Right.
And that's what we decided, though. That's what I decided I wanted to do. Because I was doing the kind of guiding side and Kristen was doing more of the lodge side and cooking and that sort of thing. She's a very good.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I find myself wondering again, like when we were talking about war. So again, like grizzly bears, you know, you could say that it's, you know, it's certainly very intriguing. It's a wonderful animal, but it's also, you know, not even a tiny bit a scary animal. And most, you know, average Westerner would think that, you know, they're violent, aggressive, you know, you must like try and avoid them at all costs. And if you see them, it's going to kill you. So can you clear that up a little bit? Like what sort of...
I mean, to put it in context, grizzly bears kill about two people a year in North America, a little bit less than two people a year. So it's not a huge chance of getting killed by a grizzly bear. They do mash up a few more people than that. So it's a skill like anything else, I suppose, is you have to understand bears. You have to understand the body language. You have to understand what stresses them and what doesn't stress them. And then you just have to watch them very, very carefully. And if they know that you're there, they will tell you what they think about you being there. And if you can interpret that and understand it, that's great. And that keeps you pretty safe. Once in a while, something slightly unexpected happens. Maybe you meet a bear very close or something, and then things can get a little bit more exciting. But you know, in the last 15 years, I think I've probably bumped into somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 bears in the bush. And I'm still, yeah, no scars, all my fingers. Right. So, you know.
Nothing ever happened. So you know, having seen 1,500 or bumping into 1,500, 2,000 bears, nothing ever was kind of life-threatening or...
There were certainly scary things. Life-threatening, right. It's very difficult to assess. I've had bears charge at me. I have bumped into bears in situations that could have gone very wrong very quickly. Mothers with cubs can be grizzly bears with cubs can be dangerous sometimes.
Right.
So I'd be lying if I said there was nothing risky about it, but it's a controlled risk. I mean, yeah. I also fly a small airplane in the mountains. It's a controlled risk. You try and mitigate the risk. You think about the risk. You try not to be a complete idiot. You try and play the numbers a bit and you figure out, you know, for example, with bears, if you're on your own, it's definitely more risky than if you're in a group. So sometimes in certain weather conditions, certain times of year, certain places, you might decide, well, I'm not really going to go in there on my own. Or if I do, I make some noise so the bear knows I'm there. Right. You know, you use the options that you have. And occasionally, very occasionally, you might just say, no, I can't do that. That's too high risk.
And so during this time that you've been there for, what was that, like 15 years, you said? Mm-hmm. You basically became a guide yourself, that, you know, you didn't need to have guides with you anymore, or were you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, in the beginning, I didn't know anything about bears or anything else or anything about the wilderness. I mean, it was completely, completely useless. Kristen turned around to me one day and said, where does the water come from? And I said, I don't know. It must come from the city. And she was like, you're kidding me. It can't come from the city. And we just didn't know where the water came from. So we figured it out. Eventually it came from a well. There you go. Right. And it was a bit like that with the bears. I didn't know what I was doing. But then I went and I found bear experts. I listened to them. I studied under them. I read a lot. I did. There were one or two courses available for bear guide training, not much. And then eventually I became a full guide. So I was a sort of an assistant guide and I became a full guide. And then about 3 years ago, I'm actually now a guide teacher. So I train other guides. I don't do much of it. But on paper, I am one of the most experienced bear guides in Western Canada. So I can train new guides.
Wow. Yeah. Congratulations. And what's the vision with all this? Do you have some sort of a vision in terms of if you look at, say, 5 years, where does this go?
I don't know. Kristen died early last year from cancer. She, I mean, it was a terrible thing that happened. It was terrible to lose her and it was terrible that she died. But there were quite a lot of good things around it in that she died, she from the diagnosis until when she died was a month. So she didn't suffer for very long. She was incredibly strong and just incredible about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And so that was something that I just had not expected in my life. I always thought, you know, I would crash my airplane into the mountain or something. In fact, about 3 months before she got sick, I almost did crash my airplane into the mountain. So if you had to bet, it was definitely going to be the one, I was going to be the one to go first.
Right.
But life, you don't know how life is going to work out. And last year was very, very difficult. But I also learned a hell of a lot. And I think going back to what we were talking about earlier about war, I think looking back at my life now, I've learned the most in times of loss and adversity. In fact, I don't even think I know that I've learned the most. So as hard as things are and as difficult it is to go through things and process things and keep moving forward and not give up, I think that's where you develop the most as a human, certainly in some aspects anyway. And now I look at myself, you know, I'm 53 years old. I've got quite a lot of scars mentally, physically a little bit, not so much perhaps. And I'm kind of comfortable with myself. I haven't quite decided what to do next. I think I'm teaching at the moment in Hungary, which I like. I like teaching. I like working with young people. I work, my guides in Canada are all young people. I love working with young people. It's cool. And it makes you feel young and fresh. I'd like to, I think, carve out a life now where I could do a little bit of war and a little bit of wilderness. And if I don't do war itself, then maybe something around it. I'm teaching about war at the moment. But there's those two very distinct sides to me. I love the city. I love the buzz of the city. You know, coming to Budapest is great, but I miss the wilderness. I miss the emptiness. I mean, at the lodge, I can walk out my front door, go to the top of the nearest mountain, and walk for 50 miles in three directions and not meet a single person. I miss that. I miss the kind of thing of camping out and just being on your own. And so hopefully I can combine a couple of different elements. I feel that I probably got another 10 or 15 years of high energy stuff to do. I'm a very active person. I don't mean that in the sense that I go hiking, although I do. I just have a lot of energy. I always have had. So I think I've got, you know, a burst of energy, 10, 15 years, realistically. And I want to do something useful with that. The other thing I feel, I mean, I've been doing some projects this year that are mostly charity projects. And I think charity is not always an easy answer to anything. It certainly doesn't always add up financially. But, you know, every time you do something that has even a partial success, you kind of bank it. It's kind of yours. Whatever happens next in your life, that can't be taken away from you. It's real. It's something that you've done. And I think, again, touching on something we talked about earlier a little bit, in this world where everything is about profile, everything is about how good you look, everything is about, you know, public persona, that means a lot to me, having those kind of basic building blocks. So that's sort of what I'm looking for going forward. But I don't have the answers yet.
No, I love that because, you know, that's really kind of related to the idea of what I call, you know, purpose seeking in life. That, you know, purpose is not about me. It is something that I do, but in service of something greater than myself. And, you know, that's when you feel like you make a difference for others. And I guess, you know, that's what I hear from your words, that you want to make, you know, an impact or a difference. And perhaps it's worth, you know, just briefly covering, you know, I read this article in The Guardian about some veterans coming to the lodge. And can you share a little bit about what that was and what was the result?
Sure. I mean, the idea goes back about 3 years and it just got delayed a lot because of COVID. But going back 3 or 4 years, I thought to myself, well, hang on a minute, if this has worked for me, if being in the bush has cured me pretty much 100% of my PTSD, maybe 90-something%, then maybe it can work for others, or maybe it can at least inspire others. And then the second, I started thinking about it, and I thought, well, hang on a minute. I actually don't agree with a lot of the way that we treat victims in our society. I think we have a terrible thing of once somebody becomes a victim, in inverted commas, we kind of put them in the corner and support them and say a few nice words to them and leave them there. And so to test this assumption, I talked to some veterans. You know, I talked to a lady who was in a wheelchair. She was a soldier in Afghanistan. And she said, yeah, that's exactly how it is. You know, you're no longer treated as a contributing member of society. And that's the worst thing. It's way worse than the injury. And I thought, something kind of clicked in my head. And I read a little bit about, it was a story that happened in Afghanistan and that reinforced it. And I thought, here's what I want to do. I want to get some veterans, bring them out to have the same experience that I had. I'm going to ask for people with PTSD, but I'm also going to ask for people with various skill sets. And I'm not just going to give them a nice time in the wilderness, but I'm going to ask them to contribute too. You know, so maybe if they're in a real mess, I have to take 9 steps towards them and they only take 1 step towards me, but they can take that 1 step. And I know from my own experience that demanding that of yourself is just healthy. It's better for you to be in this kind of supported environment that requires a contribution from you than it is to be told that you no longer serve a purpose. We'll look after you and we'll keep you alive and maybe we'll give you a disability pension, but you no longer serve a purpose. So that's where the idea came from. And that's exactly how it worked out. It worked out pretty well. So what we did, for example, is we had, you know, a sniper was amongst the veterans. So we went to the top of the mountain. We said, okay, this is how we would use this terrain to look for bears. This is the sight lines we would use. This is how we would adjust to the wind direction. This is how we would think about the way the light is falling, how shadow and silhouettes and all these different things. How would you do it? And we did a kind of a contrast and compare. And it was way more interesting than I even hoped it would be, because there were a lot of parallels. There were some things that were different. But I also found that we learned a lot. Me and my guides also learned a lot. We taught them a lot as well. So it's finding that, I hate the word synergy because it's such an overused word, but it's finding that place where everybody can contribute according to their abilities, I suppose. And actually just today I've had an email from the Invictus Games, who paid for some of the projects, and they've said it was brilliant. Can we do it again next year? So we'll see how that works out. I'm not quite sure yet.
But that's really amazing, because I think it's a core idea that when you feel like you're a victim, you know, it always amazed me. You know, I come from this Jewish heritage, and often what happens is Jews feel deeply ashamed. So survivors of the Holocaust feel deeply ashamed of it. And somehow they believe that, you know, they were at fault for what happened to them. And the only ones that actually survived or came back and found some mental peace were the people that found a new purpose, a new meaning in life, because then it empowers you, right? You as you say, you're no longer just a victim. You're actually somebody who serves a purpose and can teach, can serve, can help others. And I think that brings people back from the edge, probably.
I totally agree. I mean, look, I'm not a psychologist and I can't speak to all cases, and I'm sure this doesn't work in every case. But I think in a lot of cases, especially for certain types of people, and, you know, a lot of military people are there because they want to serve something higher than themselves. They're not there because they want to get the best for themselves. Either they're patriotic or whatever it is. And you can think about patriotism, whatever you think about it. But the fact is they are looking for this purpose that serves something else other than their own immediate interests often. And so to give them that purpose, it energizes them. It gives them meaning. And it's, you know, it's happened for me. I mean, when I was sitting out in the middle of the bush feeling sorry for myself with PTSD at the beginning, you know, I mean, the river didn't care. The trees didn't care. The bears sure as shit didn't care. You know, you just have to get up off your ass and do stuff. And I was very lucky. I had a very, very supportive, lovely woman who helped me through that whole process. So I believe that finding that purpose, finding a way to contribute again. You know, last year after Kristin died, I had 6-8 very difficult months. And then just coming back to teach in Budapest, it was nothing super special in terms of the teaching. It was great. But finally, I was doing something. I was doing something useful, hopefully, contributing something, talking to young people, explaining about things I knew. And you realize that, yes, you're unlucky. You've had a hard time. You've had a rough ride. But, you know, there are lots of other people who are unlucky in this world as well. And there are always people who are less lucky than you are. And so you just roll with it and keep going. And I think that's not just the moral thing to do, which it probably is, but it's also just better for you to take that attitude. That's my gut feeling on it. And that was the thinking behind this project. And look, it didn't work 100%. It wasn't like, this isn't Hollywood. Not everybody came out thinking, I am transformed. But for one or two people, for one guy particularly, it may actually have been life-changing. And for one other guy, a little bit. And out of six, that's okay. If it's only one person, we changed their lives for the better, then that's fine. That's worth
it. Sure. And I'm sure that you gave unforgettable experiences to the others as well, because, you know, even if they didn't put it into words and said that, thank you, you've transformed my life, I think it probably made a big difference for them too.
Yeah. Well, it made a big difference because we bumped into a grizzly bear at about 20 meters. So they would certainly remember. They'll certainly remember it.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, I do want to ask you the same question what I asked you about wars and, you know, what have you learned from them or about them? So you know, being in the wilderness and being with the bears, what would be, you know, one or two things that you would like highlight that this was something that you really got out of there that you would have never otherwise gotten that way? Or perhaps,
you know what, I haven't made up this phrase. It's something that comes from animal tracking, but there's something called dirt time. And dirt time, mm-hmm. basically, is the time you spend on your knees trying to figure stuff out, often very small stuff, trying to figure out what animal it was, when, why, how, what kind of movement, and so on and so on.
Right.
And I think that in life, there's a very healthy relationship that you need to achieve, a healthy relationship between what I think of as dirt time, which is unglamorous, which is not always, doesn't always produce results, which is just going about the business of doing what you do day after day after day after day in a conscientious way. Mm-hmm. And then occasionally you get these highlights of success or glamour or publicity. And, you know, we've had television documentaries made about us and stuff, but that's not reality. That's some weird kind of icing on the top of a very big cake. It's and we're silly, or we're misguided if we confuse those two. We need that dirt time. And that's the same in war, and it's the same in the wilderness. Something I feel very strongly is about Afghanistan. I spent a lot of time in Afghanistan. I actually worked for the British government as a political officer, but mostly I was a journalist in Afghanistan. And during the recent fall of Kabul, I felt very strongly about what was happening, but I also felt it was incredibly badly covered by a lot of the Western media. There was far too much cliche, far too many cliches flying around. And I was feeling quite despondent about this. And then I saw this fantastic 10,000 word story written by a guy who had spent months in the field in one place. And he just cut through all those cliches. And suddenly there it was, the basis, the reality of the sort of Afghan experience, at least in the countryside. Right. And that reaffirmed my belief, both in journalism and in life in general. You've got to put in those hours. You've got to put in, you know, you go out and it's wet and it's raining and it's cold and it's dark and it's miserable and you're on your own and you do not want to go out at 5:30 in the morning. But you do it. And then once in a while, you have this amazing highlight where you meet a grizzly bear up close and the sun is shining and everything's beautiful. But you need to put in the base before you reach those points, I think. So, you know, weirdly, in the world that we live, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, success is overrated and failure is underrated. Failure is a failure, loss, pain. They're really, really good teachers. Success, I'm not really sure it teaches us anything. It's nice to have it once in a while. You know, it keeps us feeling good about ourselves. But exactly. It's a double-edged sword.
So, yeah. So if we were to kind of send some sort of a message or advice, I'm hearing you say, you know, folks, get some dirt time.
I think so. Whatever it is in life that you do, get some dirt time and ignore, or at least you can't ignore the kind of, you know, social media, modern technology and everything, but at least manage it and don't allow yourself, you know, at some point you've got to spend some serious amount of time with fairly low input and quite a lot of concentration and quite a lot of thought. And that doesn't happen if you've got lights flashing at you. It's one thing we teach and we learn when we're tracking animals is that in the modern world, we're subjected to so much input the whole time. And you've got to learn when you're tracking a fox or a wolf or even a bear, you've got to learn to recalibrate your antenna so that you're picking up stuff that is fine detail, not just the big flashy stuff. And I think for me, you know, in terms of curing my PTSD, taking away all that crazy amount of input and having time to, you know, think things through and process stuff was really good for me.
Yeah, very valuable. So, you know, I'm sort of summarizing for myself. What I'm hearing is, you know, the project is get real in an unreal world that's putting you in an artificial sort of, you know, it's bombarding you with an artificial environment and a crazy amount of just information and ideas and lights. And then, you know, just get real and get some dirt time and figure out who you are, right? Maybe through that process, and just accept that you know, the glamour is the icing on the cake, and then there is the cake too.
Yeah, I think so. You know, there's a lot of bluff and bullshit in life, and I'm as bad at it as the next person. But the older I get, the more I realize that, you know, the old-fashioned values that go back hundreds of years or even thousands of years, they haven't really changed. They become more or less fashionable from one decade to the next. But, you know, generosity, honesty, honor, looking after your friends, empathy. You know, empathy is when Kristen was in hospital with dying with cancer, I discovered a whole new appreciation of what empathy actually meant. I mean, the nurses and the doctors and the people around her, it was stunning. And I sat there and I thought, hang on a minute, do I have anything like this amount of empathy in me? It was definitely a moment for self-reflection. These values have been around forever and we mustn't lose touch with them. I'm not saying you have to hide away from the modern world, which I have done a little bit in my life. I've been in the wilderness and I've been in crazy, often third world war situations. But I think you have to manage the inputs from the modern life and not lose sight of the kind of base stuff. And unfortunately, you know, the keys to that, it sounds very old fashioned and whatever, but it's the old things. It's time spent on the ground. It's hard work. It's effort. You don't just sit there and get anything for nothing. Looking in the mirror and telling yourself you look beautiful, I think, is the biggest waste of time. Just go out and do stuff. Get hurt. You know, survive, please, but get hurt, take risks, learn. That's the way to live, I think. And, you know, I don't want to die 100% healthy. I don't want to die with no scars. And no, I want to use up everything that I have. And hopefully, you know, the day that I die, then I've maximized all my resources in that sense and used them all up. So to do that, you have to get out there and you have to kind of, yeah, smash yourself around a bit, I suppose.
Love it. Yeah. I think Bernard Shaw said something like, you know, he's looking for his purpose in his life. And by the way, he's planning to die really, really tired because he wants to really exhaust all possibilities, create all experiences he could possibly can, you know, and really just get used in the process in a good way.
Yeah. So,
yeah, I can resonate with that. Thank you. You know, yeah, you were going to say?
I was going to say my pleasure. It's been really nice talking about these things.
All right. Appreciate it. Thank you. If people are interested in the Bear Lodge, I don't know if are you planning to sort of reopen or it's too early to talk about it?
We should be opening again in spring 2022.
Right.
Fingers crossed. It's a little bit early to be 100% sure, but that's the plan.
Okay. So, you know, best of luck and you know, keep doing what you're doing, because I think, you know, not only you sort of healed yourself, but it sounds like it's about to heal many others. So I think there is some really great possibilities.
You're being overly kind, but thank you for the compliments anyway.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for listening to our show. Please check our webpage at www.mentorshift.com. www.mantorshift.com. Join our newsletter and learn about the mentorship coaching and other services and resources we offer. Keep listening to our podcast for more inspiration and motivation.